Hello, everyone. Hello, Raz.
Hi, Norm. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. For anyone listening or watching, this is the second time we try to record this, so I'm going to move past the introductions and stuff. This is Classic Amateurs. We review books. We'll talk about what we read. Raz, you said you were sticking to the TV last week. We're trying to get through some classic that I'm sure we'll hear about in the future. And
I can tell you all about Seinfeld.
Oh, you're most interested in Seinfeld. Look, Seinfeld is probably as interesting as the book I'm about to talk about, if not more. Anyway, my book, just to jump into it, just conscious of time, is Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. Jonathan Haidt, as you said, go ahead.
Can you repeat the title again?
Sure.
I've never heard of this book before.
Sure. So the guy's name is Jonathan Haidt, who is a moral psychologist. And he wrote several books that are fairly popular among, I guess, nowadays, among the folks. And the book that I read is called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided on Religion and Politics. Most commonly, it's just referred to as The Righteous Mind. So he's a moral psychologist, which means that he more or less tries to understand how people judge situations, what is the underlying ideal behind it, why do they decide to do what they decide. He has quite a bit of background around why he wrote this book. I'm not going to go into it. I'm just going to have a very top-level overview. Essentially, he wanted to understand why mostly American politics are seemingly opening up, in a sense that the division, the difference between parties are increasing, people are becoming more and more hostile to each other. But I do see similar things happening here in Australia, and we probably saw similar things happening before in Europe as well. So you kind of see that drift in between parties as well as between religious groups, and he was there to understand that, to try to figure out what it is that he wants to do. And in the beginning of the book, has several chapters that deals with different topics, and the book is largely written as a academic paper. There is, I think, 1/3 of the book is just references, which was a pleasant surprise, because around 70% of the book, I was like, this is really long. And then suddenly it was over, and I was like, oh, really?
So how rewarding is that?
Yeah, that's really rewarding. There you go. It's a good book to read if you want to feel rewarded. And so the first chapter, the book itself talks about the elephant and the rider metaphor, which is something that I heard a lot before, and I didn't realize it's attributed to Haidt, or Haidt was himself who came up with it. Not sure if you heard of the elephant and the rider?
No, I'm curious. What is it?
So the elephant and the rider metaphor is the idea that when you sit on a large elephant, a really big elephant, the elephant often doesn't listen to you. It just kind of goes whichever direction. And you can try to like spank it. You can try to, that came across too sexual, but you can try to discipline it. You try to like shake some sort of, you know, carrot or whatever the relevant vegetable or fruit is. The elephant doesn't always do what you want. So oftentimes what we perceive is that the rider is on the elephant. The elephant is going to a direction, and the rider is like, yeah, this is the direction I want to go. I totally want to go this direction. I totally wanted the elephant to go this direction. It's not that the elephant just like went on his own way and I'm trying to rationalize it. But what Haidt is arguing is a lot of people make judgments based on this metaphor. A lot of their judgment come almost as a gut feeling, like almost emotionally. And then afterwards they try to rationalize it, why they decided so. And one of the key things that differentiate between people with high IQ and low IQ is that people with high IQ rationalize it better. But that doesn't mean that they are actually making better decisions. And
I love that. I agree. I think we're all kind of deterministic to some extent, at least in the short run. As you say, that overlay, the neurocortex is just there to rationalize something that we do almost instinctually.
Sure. He doesn't use the word deterministic or doesn't necessarily describe it that way, but he does explore like certain he tries to understand why we make decisions. And he does make a point that sometimes our upbringing or even our genetics can influence this. So he actually brings up, creates a questionnaire for everyone to fill in. And this is like an ambiguous questionnaire. So I'm going to read you a few questions. Are you ready?
Yeah. Okay. I'm ready. Yeah.
So here's your job. This is what you need to do, right? You need to decide if you think this is what happened in this situation was right, this or wrong. And if it was wrong, why do you think it is wrong? Right? So, example.
So it's an ethics quiz. Yeah.
Morals, ethics, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So question one, a family dog was killed by a car in front of their house. They had heard that dog meat was delicious. So they cut up the dog's body and cooked it and ate it for dinner.
Did they hear this right after wrong. The... Were they aware of this?
This is the situation you're given. By the way, there's no right or wrong answer. It's not about... There's no, you know, solution to this. It's just you, whatever your opinion is.
I mean, my gut feel tells me you shouldn't be eating dogs. That's for sure.
Okay.
But every ethical decision depends a bit on the context, because if they're truly hungry and they actually, in their culture, they believe eating dogs is appropriate, they might actually salvage the dog for their own benefit. But in most cultures, you usually don't eat dogs, especially if you're not extremely hungry.
So I'm hearing a lot of that post-rationalization, right? But... to be fair, there's no context given. I think based on the description, even in the book, they are probably not hungry, and they probably live in a westernized culture just like us. So, you know, there's no reason why they should eat the dog. It actually also says they heard that the dog meat is delicious. So it isn't something that they regularly do. It's a few things to try. All right, question two. A brother and sister like to kiss each other on the mouth. When nobody is around, they find a secret hiding place and kiss each other on the mouth. Right or wrong?
Again, it's the same gut reaction, isn't it? And then you kind of, as you say, rationalize. I think they're all very, very intimate biological reactions. The first one may be related to you shouldn't be eating dogs because dogs eat a lot of stupid stuff, and they probably eat a lot of meat, and we don't like things that have high mercury. In the second situation, you probably know that you shouldn't be involved with anyone that's really, really close to you because of the risks this has on your potential children you might have. And there's something wrong there, you know. I'm trying to rationalize why. Maybe that's where this gut reaction comes from.
It's okay. It's not, again, there's no like right or wrong answer. If you think it's wrong, that's fine. What I'm interested in is, I'm interested in how you rationalize it, right? Now, keep in mind, this is just about brother and sister kissing. They are not, you know, reproducing or anything. There's no incest.
No,
there, right?
But it's kind of, of course.
Yeah, sure.
It's still wrong.
Actually, the book version talks about them having sex one time, using protection, and then deciding and they don't want to do it again. Right? But that doesn't matter. The point is the same. Yeah. Here's the third one. Another eating one. A man goes to the supermarket once a week and buys a dead chicken, mostly dead. But before cooking the chicken, he has sexual intercourse with it. Then he through cooks it and eats it. It's worth adding that this man is alone. He's not cooking it for a family or sharing the meat with anyone. Yes,
sir. Am I here to say that necrophilia /zoophilia, because it's both, is wrong? Why are those two things wrong?
Well, every meat eating is necrophilia. Because necrophilia is having sex with that. Okay, sorry, I misunderstood. But yeah, sure. So you think it's wrong?
I can't think of anything. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why it's wrong, but it's very hard to explain it's wrong, isn't it? There's something just wrong about it.
So Jonathan Haidt does spend most of his time in the book explaining why. Not necessarily only these examples, but overall every difference in opinion and judgment, right? And what's important to note, and this is what he talks about in the first chapter, is that a lot of these judgments, what you say, the gut feeling, comes from the gut and not from the mind. So you kind of know already that it's wrong before even like think it through. You know, you just have to think about the chicken getting fucked and then being eaten, and you're like, that's wrong. And by the way, I agree with you. I would think it's wrong as well. So
just as a disclaimer.
Just as a disclaimer before anyone thinks anything. Fun fact, just to take a step back before we move forward, is the reason I picked this book is because I was listening to this podcast, and this guy in the podcast reads a lot. Like, he reads like 3 books every single week. And he said, look, if you want to read a book that increases your IQ by 20 points, read The Righteous Mind. And I was like, I definitely need 20 points of IQ, if you know me. So I'm going to read it. And yeah, I don't know, I don't feel the uptake yet. I'm not saying I just finished reading it, so I'll inform you how it goes.
Maybe take some time to mature. Yeah, maybe a few nights of sleep.
Sure. I think about it during my runs. So essentially, here's the thing, right? So why... So you want to move on? Do you want to know what's next?
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah, now you've opened, especially the last one, because I can't rationalize it, but I know it's wrong. I can feel it's wrong, right? Really curious what he has to say.
I'm a little disappointed because there's not that much explanation on it afterwards, but it does talk about what influences it. So what Jonathan Haidt realized is that essentially there are, he calls it moral foundations. Sometimes he referred to it as moral framework. I don't want to sound like too stuck up on my inside myself, I just call it moral foundations for the sake of convenience. And he breaks it down that there are 6 moral foundations that everyone uses in their life. And depending on who you are, where you come from, what's your cultural background, what's your genetic background, your IQ, and so on, it will influence it. So even moving into a new city, moving into a new environment will influence this. Essentially, there are 6 of them. One is care and harm, which is very simple, you know, how much harm or how much care we do. When we see a child being punched by an adult, you're like, this is wrong because, you know, the child is smaller, it's harming, adult is harming them. You will not judge it as much when an adult punching another adult, although, you know, they're still going to, something similar will happen. Then
they might, may I add, may I, sorry, I was just going to add to that, that it sounds like in the case of babies, you might have an instinctual caring mechanism that is really wired into your brain to care for infants.
I'll go into that as well in a second. So the second one is fairness and cheating. This is the bit where, well, cheating, you know, when you say people cheat in competition, in their relationship, you tend to judge them because, you know, you feel like they are, you know, having, it's not fair, right? Then the third one is loyalty. This comes back to a little bit to cheating, but it's also related to things like treachery, right? A good example for that from literature is Dante's Inferno, where he keeps one of the circles in hell for treacherous people. So just betraying your team, your country, your family, that sort of stuff.
By the way, just on that, I think that's the worst place in hell, potentially, right? Where people that betray are treacherous end up. So obviously it speaks to the severity of this.
You know, You can go around killing thousands of people and then you go down to hell and you're like, well, I'm not as bad as that guy. That guy betrayed his family. So it's weird, but nevertheless, right? So fourth one is authority, which is just, you know, disrespecting parents or leaders, depending on context. Again, it can change depending on the background. Fifth one is sanctity. A lot of this is religious, so things like religious symbols and principles, but also things like disrespecting the flag. One of the examples Jonathan Haidt uses, and that comes up a lot in American politics, is that when you like take the flag and then use it inappropriately, right? So you have a flag and you cut it up and you use it to clean up, or you burn a flag. That's something I saw in Eastern Europe as well. Some people burning the flag are not considered to be very nice.
Yeah, it's a big deal in the U.S. It's almost a religious act to some extent of worshiping the flag or burning the flag. And
well, yeah, yeah. But I mean, that's, I think in a way it's true here as well. Like if you see someone burning an Australian flag, or even at home, if you see someone burning your flag, you'd be a bit like, what's wrong with that guy? You know, like that's clearly some, it isn't just like, oh, there's a flag, I'm just put it on flame because why does it matter? Although, you know, it's just a cloth. It's just a colored cloth. And then there's the final one, which is liberty and oppression. That's a very interesting one as well. And he talks a lot about politics and religion, so he brings that up quite a bit. But liberty and oppression is really just how free you are, whether, you know, someone's trying to oppress you or someone's trying to push you down. This isn't the same as authority, where, you know, authority could be a father figure, but oppression would be someone that's trying to prevent you from moving out or, you know, doing something just out of spite, right? So
interesting how he structures. Interesting, because I don't know if they don't seem very mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive to me. You know, they're kind of like, some of them resemble each other quite a bit. I feel like there's a bit of overlap between, as you mentioned, treachery, but also loyalty, authority.
And look, well, the thing is, when you talk about generalized models, you have overlaps, because you cannot be too specific, because then you will find too many examples that don't fit either of them, right? So you have to be somewhat generic about it. And that's a fair point. He doesn't really address that. He kind of just groups them together. One of them he calls the individual morals. This is based on like the French Revolution thing. So things like fairness, care, and liberty. While the other one is group level stuff, which is loyalty, authority, and sanctity. Now, this is the bit where it gets interesting, because he talks about how psychology and moral ideation worked over the past 30 years. And he says that at one point in history, people said there's no such thing as group rationality, or there's no such thing as group level, I guess, optimization and judgment. It's always individual. It's always individuals making their decisions and benefit the group or not, right? But what he says is that based on his research, there is definitely a group level dynamic. So what he does is he says, people are 90% chimpanzees and 10% bees. What chimpanzees and bees mean here is chimpanzees are individual. Chimpanzees do things alone. They don't give a shit about each other. There's a really interesting study, by the way, on the side that I read, is that when it comes to chimpanzees, one chimpanzee dragging a log or just something heavy, you never see another chimpanzee helping them. Two chimpanzees never work together to carry something, but you see that with humans. And there is something called shared intentionality, where someone does something and you recognize that is in your intent as well to help them out. And that's something that's very unique to humans. And this leads us to the second group of morals, which is the group level morals, the authority, the loyalty, and sanctity. These are the morals that build on the relationship people have each other or with the group they are in. These groups, when we talk about groups, we don't necessarily talk about large groups. We don't necessarily talk about nations. We talk about smaller groups, could be a few hundred, maybe a few thousand, depending on how you define a group. And this is where he does quite a lot of interesting insights. Like, for example, religious groups are way more likely to donate to charity than secular groups, as well as historically, religiously based organizations that are, even if they were not religious in goal-wise, but they were religious to some aspect, were more likely to survive than secular groups that just kind of gathered based on an interest. And he kind of brings up the idea that while you could, and let me take a step back here. Early 2000, there was this thing called the New Atheism. This was things like the Richard Dawkins and the like. They wrote quite a lot of good books called like God Delusion, and the other stuff, where they define religion as just being irrational and useless and root of evil, that sort of stuff, right? That's their logic. They're the new atheist movement. And now, Jonathan Haidt doesn't say they are wrong, but Jonathan Haidt says, look, what they fail to recognize is that religion as an entity has an organizing power for groups that holds groups together more than anything else. And historically, this can be proved, that religion helped quite a lot of cultures and groups just survive centuries of hardships, while secular groups just failed during the same exact time. So
Well,
he
we spoke about
creates this.
this before in the sense, I mean, I don't know how he defines it from a scientific point of view. How do you define sanctity is something that eludes me, but the idea of having a shared purpose as a group definitely makes you kind of more united and potentially more likely to survive in the long run than if you don't have any purpose. And that's kind of what religion is at the highest level, is a common sense of purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And he does make a really good point here, is when you look at the purpose that you create, because you can create a secular group with a purpose. You could create, you know, we are vegetarians and we are, you know, fighting for animal rights. That's a secular goal, right?
Or a
While
corporation,
something
right? Has
religious,
the it's used
or a
extensively.
corporation.
Every corporation has a corporate mission, has values, you know, almost a
Absolutely.
semi, a pseudo science, pseudo religious aspect to it, and it makes it
100%.
function to some extent. Otherwise, if you don't have those things, everyone's sort of chaotic, don't know what they're up to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, he talks about corporations. Let me get back to that in a second. The point is that he does point out that what you often like, even like the amount of sacrifice you need to do for the group doesn't necessarily influence how long the group will survive. So just because you have to, you know, put your money in it, just because you have to sacrifice your time for it, doesn't mean that the group will survive. However, when a shared ideology and a shared group is hard to explain, hard to rationalize, it tends to stay together longer. So based on that, if you create a group with a shared commonality, you want to create something or a shared purpose, you want to make sure the purpose is vague enough not to have too many questions, even if it's a secular group, because it helps to survive for the group. And talking, go ahead if you have anything, by the way.
Interesting what you're saying about the vagueness, but I think it has to be concrete enough so that people understand it and rally around it. But maybe when you say vague, you mean it has a certain dimension of difficult to attain, potentially, because
Well,
then
like
it
religions.
drives action. Yeah.
Well, like religions are, you know, like you could say, you know, religion has a specific goal. But then when you start dwelling on it, what exactly that means, it becomes a bit vague, right? Because it's either there are too many things going on. The point is that he does talk about what he calls the hive switch, which is simply just the idea that you trigger hive for the bees. So the idea of hive for the bees or the hive switch is that it triggers that group level morality. And he talks about him being, he's American, so him being around at 9/11 when the attack on the Twin Towers happened, and how he felt the sudden urge of supporting American businesses, putting money forward to charities, putting American flag to his car. And he said there was no actual rational reason for that, because, you know, he stamping his car with the American flag doesn't mean that he's actually helping anyone. There's no rational idea behind it, yet he still felt that urge. And he called this the hive switch that helps people to suddenly think of decisions in a group sense. So he talks about hive switches, like sport events are typical hive switches. When you go to a sport event and you sing along, you dance along with people, very typical dancing, raves, drugs, that sort of stuff can also trigger hive switches. On a secular term, something like a chess club could be one as well. So any like something that's regular, you we regularly come together and do a podcast, that's a hive switch as well, that helps us to sometimes do things or judge things, although it's not in our best interest. You know, you could be spending your time with the family eating good food, but you are here listening to me rambling about a book.
I mean, I do that all the time. This is exciting. I'm learning
Yeah,
things rather
absolutely.
than. But
Absolutely. And
interesting what
just
you say
to
about identity. I think we spoke about identity as well. I relate to that. What you said earlier about kicking activating a beehive identity. I think we often make decisions at an individual level. We're mostly like chimps to some extent. You know, we look after ourselves. But in some situations, especially under threat, we tend to become a bit tribal. And that's
Yeah.
kind of the symbols that you mentioned, putting up a flag, spending money. They're all symbols of kind of tribalism, looking after other people in the hope that they look after you, and this ensures kind of
Reciprocity.
protection. Yeah, for the whole group.
Yeah, absolutely. You totally got it. That's exactly what he's talking about, right? These things that humans actually do, but animals rarely, right? He actually talks about that the only real, like, he does raise a few questions, like chimps do hunt together, for example. But he says that based on research, it often seems that it's a coincidence in a way that chimps just tend to be hungry at the same time. So they hunt together because in the end of the hunt, they still fight with each other for the food. So there's not really any like group level cooperation there. And when one chimp fucks it up in the middle of the hunt, no one cares and he doesn't tell anyone.
There's a lot of treachery. There's a lot of treachery with chimps.
Well, you could say that, or you could say that there's just no loyalty. So if there's no loyalty, then there's no treachery, right? Anyway, so in his last chapter of his book, he talks about religion and politics. He talks about how religion helped to, you know, organize farmers in like Vietnam, how religion helped to some of the more smaller sects to survive, that sort of stuff. And then he talks about politics, how, you know, left and right.
The smaller sects.
He talks about an American... The smaller sex. So when then
you mean
dirty
you mean women
bastard.
You sure. Mean
and
women. Okay.
And for our female listeners, right?
Listeners. You do have a girlfriend.
Yes. And yeah, I'm just teasing you. So ultimately, there is what I want to say. I lost my train of thoughts.
Sorry.
Yeah, he talks about left and right division and in what sense are what who we call leftists are correct and what sense who we call right wing are correct. So he lists a bunch of ideas that he says like both parties need to recognize. So he's very much a middleman. He's very much like a centrist who says, listen, both sides have some ideas that we need to consider and recognize that it's a valid point. So he kind of tries to bring the two sides together. And I think that's a pretty good idea, and it's very interesting how he explores different topics, whether it's corporate regulations or whether that's, you know, the moral framework that our society lives and works in. And just to go back to the corporation comment, so he actually calls them superorganisms. And superorganism is a biological term. Apparently, it's when two cells connect and they form another cell that works together to solve a problem. It's an evolutionary stage. So similarly, corporations are superorganisms because they are different people grouping together and doing things together. And what he says is that these superorganisms do have the tendency to take over everything else. So there is a valuable argument to be made that a lot of these corporations are growing, you know, so big that they are more powerful than some of the nation states and possibly be, you know, bigger or better than some of the nation states. However, there's definitely a conflict of interest because the thing is with corporations is that they are not necessarily honest or they are not necessarily good. He does bring a lot. One of the Greek philosophers up. I'm trying to remember what his name is. Gluconian, I think. Glaucon was the brother of Plato, and he made this the Ring of Gyges. You know the Ring of Gyges, the story about the Ring of Gyges.
No,
so the idea of Ring of Gyges is that you have the Ring of Invisibility. It's nothing to do with Lord of the Rings, but it's similar. So you have the Ring of Visibility. And in the story, Gyges, the guy who finds the ring, puts it on and then starts doing like really selfish stuff. So he sleeps with the queen, he betrays the king, he does nasty stuff. And then what Glaucon says is that what if, you know, you have a person that is perfectly, you know, it's a good guy and you have a person that's a bad guy. So you give the Ring of Invisibility to the bad guy, he will go and do all this treacherous stuff. But if you give the Ring of Invisibility to a good guy, he will probably still do quite a lot of treacherous stuff. He will do a lot of selfish things because he cannot get caught. He has no responsibility. There's nothing that will hold him to his own morals and his own values. And what he says, what he insists is that essentially if you are not transparent and you cannot be held responsible, people can fall back to bad habits or being selfish. and what a lot of you know, the corporations, a lot of corporations start to become good guys is when they are being transparent, when you know what's up, when you know what's going on. So no, it's,
I agree with that. It's very easy to hide yourself. I don't think that corporations can be good or bad themselves. That's just my opinion. I think individuals can be good or bad, but I can see a situation where you're camouflaged inside a group identity such as a corporation, and you make decisions and you can get away with stuff because you're putting a facade that it's actually the higher institution making the decision. It's not you. So institutions, especially in a lack of transparency, can be very good at shielding individual responsibility in that way. It wasn't me. Absolutely. It was the party that wanted me to kill these people. I had no choice. You know, that's
yeah. Well, that leads us to collectivist ideologies, which is, I guess, it's an extreme version of what he calls the hive switch. And he does talk about it as well. But just to stick to the corporations, but yeah, what you're saying is completely true, is that if corporations aren't necessarily good or evil, they're just corporations. They're just there to make profit, sell a product or a service. But if they are not transparent and they have all these resources, they can deal with it without anyone keeping them responsible, then they will either waste it or use it for nefarious reasons. Because they are selfish. Because they do it for themselves. But if there's a transparency, whether that is like a mission statement, that is some sort of transparency statement, you know, the all sort of like anti-slavery act that, you know, corporations sign, remember those? That helps to keep them good, right? Almost every company in Australia has I call it anti-slavery statement, but I think it's something like modern slavery statement. I'm not sure exactly how it's called. But yeah, so these stuff help quite a bit. And he talks about, you know, this is something that everyone needs to recognize, is that sometimes regulations work. He also talks about healthcare costs and how actually a free market would probably fix a lot of the issues that Americans have with healthcare, or that you see in the world. And he makes a pretty good point. And then he talks about moral communities and some other stuff. But I don't
know. So he is really a centrist in that sense, because I was under the impression that he was more atheist Democrat, but it sounds like he's really kind of in the middle, also believing a bit in free market solving things.
Well, no, not necessarily. So he considers himself a liberal. He actually worked with one of the Democratic candidates at one point, but he does, I think he makes a point in the book where he says, this is not a prescriptive book, this is a descriptive book. I'm trying to explain why things are different, not how things should be different. So that's why he brings it up. Like, look, the reason is that the reality is that the reason we survived so long, the reason why our society went so far, is because we have these six moral principles that people base their judgment on, and they are constantly struggling to pick the right one for the situation. And when you only have one party, or when you have only one authoritarian ruler, or you only have one ideology, it could be a religion, it could be anything, that only decides based on one single framework, then things go off the rail very quickly and very easily. That's why you end up with really bad stuff. But when you have a democratic system, or at least a system where people talk to each other, where they form communities to discuss their values, or they open-minded, it helps to keep things moving forward to the right direction, even if it's a painful long process. So I think he pretty much lands in the center. It could be argued, it's unclear whether he thinks it's you know, if this is the right thing or a wrong thing. Anyway, that's really more or less it. I think we can wrap up. Any other thoughts, questions?
No, I liked it. I think it touches upon some very, very good things. And I like the fact that he's not prescriptive, and he is indeed trying to ask himself some really good questions. What drives moral behavior? Especially in a situation where, you know, leaving kind of the religion aside, what are the drivers in a kind of a atheistic society that are still animating people? Is it individual? Is it the group? Which are the two main dimensions that kind of surround us constantly in our kind of our general framework. Do you feel like it will ever increase your IQ? Or by
I
how
feel
much
like
do
it
you think?
You know, it's actually crazy because he does talk about how the idea of like group level decisions and morals have been ignored for decades. So while I'm not saying he's like the first one who brings it up again, but his book is definitely indicates a paradigm shift in moral psychology, and that could lead us to completely different interactions in the future. So I think it's definitely something I recommend everyone, whether you like to eat your dog or not, you know. That's it.
It's up to you.
Or kiss your sister or whatever.
What so if she's a stepsister?
Stepsister, nah, that's
no, that's
although,
a different
although,
for another episode.
I have a girlfriend, I can't talk about it. Although I don't have a stepsister, so it's not relevant. Right. But
it was really good chatting to you, Norm. I feel like I've learned something tonight.
Yeah.
There's a difference between a sister and a stepsister.
Absolutely. Anyway. That's it. Have a good evening.
That's a wrap.